You're listening to SBS News.
A new law for government-funded aged care in Australia is due to come into effect on November the 1st. The commencement of the new Aged Care Act comes more than 4 years after the final report of the Royal Commission into Aged Care was handed down, with 148 recommendations for change. The new law aims to address 58 of those recommendations, including a universal right to aged care based on assessed need. Described by the federal government as a once-in-a-generation reform, the new act aims to shift the focus from structuring care around providers and how to fund them, towards a rights-based, person-centred model of care. The Inspector General of Aged Care, Natalie Siegel-Brown, has conducted a detailed assessment of progress made in implementing the Royal Commission recommendations. In this episode of Weekend 101, I spoke with Ms. Siegel-Brown about the findings, particularly as it impacts First Nations and culturally diverse communities.
My report really comments on the system as a whole. Delivery of aged care packages is important. The upcoming reform that we're going to see with the new piece of legislation is really quite seminal in terms of the government's implementation of the Royal Commission's recommendations. However, what my report raises is a fear that the mechanisms that sit behind the legislation, the things that are required to bring it to life, they are not there yet. And indeed, in the flurry of activity that we've seen to make reform happen, there may in fact be some unintended consequences. So I'm looking for some of the bigger picture things that need to happen to breathe life into an act that gives you the right to not just your human rights, but to aged care that positions your dignity, your identity, compassion, kindness, your life experience front and centre. And I don't think that's part of our aged care system now. I think it requires much more paradigmatic reform.
The report runs over 200 pages, split into Part A, Part B, looking at the legacy of the Royal Commission, what's happened 4 to 5 years on with those 100 plus recommendations, but also some big pieces of legislation, the Aged Care Reform Act, but also this co-payments system. It covers a lot of ground, but if we maybe start off with the Royal Commission, I mean, it's many years since that's happened. Many advocates in the sector were hoping for some of this seminal big picture change that you've spoken of. What's been your assessment of how the government is tracking in terms of implementing some of those findings and noting that when we talk about aged care, there is a role here for the federal government, but also here for the states as well?
That's exactly right. So the report was very much focused on what the Commonwealth government needs to do. However, of course, it did make some commentary on the interaction of state-based systems, and there is a huge role for them to play as well. It's very easy for government to get siloed into who does what, and as a result, sometimes we don't see that joined-up delivery that we should see. Ultimately, aged care should be seen as the remit of local government, state government and federal government working together. And if they did work together, well, I think we would see savings across all of them. Really, the biggest thing here is that when we talk about an Aged Care Act that positions rights at the centre, that defines the care you deserve by 18 planks of really fantastic stuff. Really, in a nutshell, it says you should be entitled to the same quality of life and dignity and connection to society that you had before you started aging and needing care. That is a very noble aim, but that really requires us to step back and rethink the way we administer the system and whether it is actually geared with the right incentives and disincentives to motivate providers to deliver the really noble ambition of that act. And then I think what we need to do is then ask ourselves, if we haven't done that, if we're just changing an existing system, have we just replaced a system that regulates providers with an even more heavily compliant one, one that is perhaps even more burdensome around its reporting requirements, but it's not, its central motivation is not the person who we are caring for. So I think we've made a landmark step with this piece of legislation. You have to start somewhere, and the law is perhaps the most brilliant place to start. It is setting the compass, but it's got to be more than aspiration. It's a mandate, and I don't think we have the mechanisms to enforce that mandate at the moment. For example, human rights were the centrepiece of the Royal Commission, and while we have a statement of rights that, while it doesn't cover every single right the Royal Commission sought, it covers a lot, there is still very little to enable you to enforce your human rights within the Act.
And in terms of the perverse outcomes, the unintended consequences you mentioned a little earlier, what are those specific concerns that you have? And I assume they are tied to the fact that we have this imminent reform about to be rolled out.
That's right. So perhaps chief among those for me, there's really two. One relates to the way in which co-payments are being structured under the new system, and the other relates to the mainstreaming of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander aged care. So in relation to co-payments, when 1 November comes around and the Act commences, what will happen is that for almost everybody, your clinical care will be 100% funded. However, there are some elements of your care that are not strictly defined in the model as clinical care, and I'll come to that in a minute, to which everybody will have to contribute. Even a full pensioner will have to make a level of contribution. So to give you an example, showering. If a full pensioner needs support with showering, they will have to contribute 5% of the cost of their showering. Now, if they want a shower each day, which most of us enjoy and take for granted and see as a straightforward part of our dignity, they will have to ensure that they have the money to contribute to that 5%. And when you think about that cumulatively on the other forms of care to which they'll have to contribute, that can really mount up and mean that people are forsaking some of the essentials like heating or cooling or food or even opportunities to go out into the community. Things like cleaning, which may seem at first blush like a luxury, to somebody who has a colostomy bag that regularly breaks, this is a really essential item. And under the model of co-payments, that would attract a 17.5% contribution from a full pensioner. So my concern is that those with the least means in our community may have to forsake the most under the model of co-payments. And indeed, that actually might push people earlier into residential care, which costs the taxpayer more. So I do feel that that needs to be revisited, because if we're talking about a mandate for care that is dignified and that keeps people aging in place connected to their community most, these co-payments may in fact jeopardise that. In relation to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander aged care, at the moment, contrary to the Royal Commission's recommendations, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander aged care will be mainstreamed. The Royal Commission said very rightly that mainstream approaches to looking after Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, many of whom are members of the stolen generation or survivors of child removal practices, is highly culturally unsafe and inappropriate. So I believe it's vital, from what I've found, that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander aged care is pulled out of the mainstream system, separately funded, and that there is end-to-end co-design that takes place.
With the co-payment structure, do you see a way that could be salvaged, or are you saying it just needs to be scrapped and we need to revise the whole system, the whole structure?
Biwa, every government wrestles with finite budgets, and I think that is just an incontrovertible fact. And this is a budget that is going to experience exponential demand over time. So I think it's unrealistic to think that there should just be this complete universal system, as much as I'd love to think that everybody is going to be able to get everything they need 100% funded. What I'm saying is, so first of all, really important to know, the co-payments model was not a recommendation of the Aged Care Royal Commission. It came out of a subsequent Aged Care Task Force. I am not drawing the concept into question, but I am drawing the implementation and the way it's been structured into question. So I think at very least, we need to revisit the fact that anybody on any form of pension, full pension or part pension, makes any contributions at all to their care. I think if we rethought the small amount that it takes to cover that 5% of showering or 17.5% of cleaning for somebody who is a full pensioner, that if we compare that to the cost to the government purse of them being in residential aged care, there's a much higher cost at that end. So I'm saying let's have a really good hard look at whether it's in fact economic to be charging a co-payment to those who are poorest in society. And of course, my chief concern, perhaps more than the economics, and now I can actually assure you that my concern is greater than the economics, is the human rights cost that is forfeited in all of that.
The demographics are very clear in terms of the size of the population. We have the ageing cohort of people over 65, but a shrinking size of the working age population that it can afford to pay this. And this is a trend that's just going to be magnified over the next coming decades. You've just alluded to, you realise, or we all kind of recognise, some of those challenges around cost. Is there a solution there that's been examined in the Royal Commission and the work that you've done that addresses this conundrum?
The Royal Commission actually sought that there be a universal right to aged care. So they didn't examine the economics of it in great detail. I believe that they thought that a universal right to funded aged care was in fact feasible. And I certainly haven't done the economic modelling myself. What I'm most concerned about here is whether we have in fact structured co-payments for support at home. And I'll give some examples of some other areas in a minute, where if we made that investment upstream in people's ability to remain independent and connected to their loved ones within their community, we can actually save a whole bunch of much more expensive downstream costs. So I think some economic modelling is absolutely in order here, because I think we could be smarter about the way we are investing. And if we look at the scientific evidence, and if we look around the world, investing in things that keep people integrated into their community, emotionally and mentally stimulated, we can actually prevent a lot of physical and cognitive decline. Dental care is a really perfect example where the dental scheme that the Royal Commission recommended has not been funded in quite the same way as the Royal Commission anticipated or recommended. If we invested in that dental scheme, we know how much people's oral health is actually connected to dementia symptoms, and indeed a lot of the older people who come through our hospitals are there for their oral health. So investing in something like a scheme like that might actually save the aged care funding bucket a lot more money, meaning that a lot more people can receive aged care quicker.
This report that you've compiled is a way of tracking the progress, and it's the first time we've actually seen some of the pieces come together post the Royal Commission, but also reviewing the kind of, I guess, regulatory oversight, the complaints mechanism, particularly after the COVID pandemic and the impact on some of our older Australians. What would you say has been, you know, and it's always hard to summarise and boil that down, but as I'm always very interested to speak to people who have been working in the sector for so long, when you're able to, and you've made great efforts to kind of paint that bigger picture for our listeners to help understand this complex framework that regulates the space, but like some of your personal reflections on how the system is working in terms of what you've been able to pick up. We're now years out from a COVID pandemic, years out from a Royal Commission. Are we still seeing some of the stories that were shared in the Royal Commission happening very much in this contemporary moment?
So my report was tracking progress until the 1st of January this year. And up until that point, I would have to say to you that, yes, we were still hearing some of the same stories around the way complaints were managed, the opacity in receiving feedback, the fear of retribution by people in residential aged care, by their loved ones, even by workforce. However, I can say that there has been significant progress by the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commission to really increase the efficacy of complaints. And there's a real commitment to also increase the cultural safety of the complaints process for people. There is still a lot of work to do, and of course my office will monitor that closely, but there have been some improvements. I think the new Act will be a marked step forward, but we want to make sure this new Act is not just pretty words on a page, that it does actually have the mechanisms to breathe life into it, and that is still something that the jury is out on.
And in terms of some of the ways that we could be approaching thinking about this differently, you've mentioned how maybe, I guess, a more preventative approach might reduce some of the costs down the line. One of the things that really emerged was this poor nutrition in the aged care setting environments. Is much being done to improve that situation from your understanding?
I think a lot more needs to be done with respect to nutrition in aged care. It's not an area that has a lot of regulatory requirements around it, and it could definitely be strengthened. So we know for people who identify as part of our culturally and linguistically diverse communities, food is really important to reflecting culture and feelings of belonging, but equally nutrition within that food, leaving aside the importance of food to, you know, what you look forward to in a day and how you feel your culture is valued and recognised. Nutrition is really important to things like falls prevention and preventing your decline. So it's areas like that, like dental care, where we could be investing a whole lot more upstream to see a lot of change. Equally, there is so much science now about some of the things we can do to prevent dementia in later life. So you talked about the exponential growth of the aging population. For those of us in our 40s, like me, there's things that we can be doing now that will actually mean we are aging more healthily for longer. And I would love to see more investment in those things.
One of the other areas that was perhaps a bit confronting in the Royal Commission was the discussion around restraints or restrictive practices. Mm. What's the progress that's been made in that space?
Look, we were saddened to see that obviously freedom of movement and freedom from restraint was not necessarily it is not a right that is codified in the new statement of rights within the Aged Care Act. And that is, of course, problematic. And when you couple that with the fact that rights don't have any enforcement mechanism under the new Act, that's a significant concern. It was a very clear finding from our report, from the data we examined and from the people we spoke to, that not enough is being done to reduce the use of restrictive practices. They are still being over-relied upon, and there's a whole range of things relating to the education of the workforce around, for example, the psychological symptoms of dementia, the way people communicate, that actually could vastly reduce and eliminate the use of restrictive practices. And I can tell you from having spent a lot of time, even as an approver of restrictive practices in a different life, in a different career, that the disability sector, while it still has a long way to go, is actually far further ahead in this regard. So the mantra in the disability sector is all about reducing and eliminating the use of restraints, but we do not see that as an embedded part of the administration of the aged care system, which I think is disappointing given that was one of the fundamental matters that brought about the Royal Commission.
A lot of these issues are tied together, particularly around workforce. Aged care disability has been seen as one of the areas of critical skill shortages, and you've just mentioned training as being a critical component in ensuring proper implementation. What are you seeing there in terms of whether we're further along in terms of addressing some of those issues? The federal government has approved a rise, I guess, in the aged care worker wages, but many in the sector argue it's still way too low, and there isn't the turnover rate is quite high, which doesn't support high quality care. What are your reflections on that?
Look, I think there's no doubt that this government has made a really significant investment in the aged care workforce, and workforce shortages across the care sector are obviously not an unfamiliar issue. As you would know, the recent productivity roundtables focused very heavily on this. My concern very much relates to the lack of mandatory training that we are seeing in some of these key spaces. So, for example, we talked about restraints just before. Mandatory training around the psychological symptoms of particular diseases that are common to ageing, like dementia, would mean there is a reduction in the use of restraints, because people would better understand that behaviour is a function of communication very often. Sometimes behaviours are as a result of the fact that people are confused, and that proper behaviour support would completely change the dial. It's the same thing when we talk about cultural safety for both Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, and also for members of our culturally and linguistically diverse communities. There's no mandatory training around those things. So it's important to invest in the workforce in terms of salaries and recruitment and retention, but equally we need to see an investment. Well, it's not just investment, but a requirement that providers training their staff in these things, and that that training is mandatory before they can be registered.
You mentioned one of the perverse outcomes that stands out to you is this mainstream of aged care services and the impact on First Nations Australians. In terms of the overall approach, because we know that the population will all age at some point, so the intersectionality aspect is really writ large in a sense. There will be cultural diversity, there will be disability, there will be First Nations. How are we grappling with that? Mainstream aged care services often don't deal well with complex health needs or with the culturally diverse needs of our ageing Australians. How is the kind of reform that's put forward dealing with those aspects? Are we able to address some of those?
I think that this is an area where a whole lot of work is still outstanding. So for our First Nations communities, the recommendation was that the aged care system for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is co-designed together with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and Aboriginal community-controlled organisations, and that they are not mainstreamed, but they are block-funded until that proper end-to-end specialist aged care for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders occurs. I think that is an absolute non-negotiable. That just must happen. And again, I think I've mentioned how many people over the age of 50 who are First Nations are members of the Stolen Generation or Child Removal Practices. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander aged care providers really centre spiritual, emotional care, connection to community and kin as a core part of what they do. If they are mainstreamed, they will have to collect co-payments at the highest level of contribution from their elders for that kind of care, because that kind of care actually attracts the highest co-payment, even for full pensioners. That then becomes countercultural to the way in which they operate. And I have really grave concerns that, contrary to the Royal Commission's ambition that we increase the number of Indigenous aged care providers, we may actually see an alienation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community-controlled providers from the aged care sector. Similarly, The fact that there is no mandatory cultural safety training, or what the Royal Commission referred to as trauma-aware, healing-informed training for the aged care workforce in caring for our elders from the culturally and linguistically diverse communities, and of course acknowledging there's a huge amount of diversity within those communities. That really concerns me, because what the Royal Commission was looking for was non-discriminatory care as a bedrock of the system. And I can't see at the moment how we are creating a requirement for non-discriminatory, culturally responsive, trauma-aware, healing-informed care within the way we administer the system.
Some of the advocates in the sector are really concerned that this new act that's about to come into effect doesn't really embed human rights and a robust enforcement mechanism within it. What are your thoughts on whether you see that as the case, and does there need to be another piece of legislation ensuring that, Australia jurisdictionally only has human rights charters in the ACT and Victoria, and the Constitution is very limited in express human rights offered? Unfortunately, older Australians fall in a lot of different buckets, and the overarching protective framework hasn't been in place. And I think that's why a lot of advocates in the space are looking forward to this new act to achieve a lot of things that have been left unaddressed for a very long time. But what are your thoughts there on whether we have the appropriate level of care and attention to human rights and enforcement in this act?
Look, I'm absolutely stoked to see the human rights statement within the Act. It is absolutely imperative that we see this Act commence on the 1st of November. I don't think we can wait any longer for that to occur. But as you rightly point out, there are no solid enforcement mechanisms within the Act for the entrenchment of those human rights. Now, while we may not have the legislative architecture right, there are still things that we can do to ensure rights are enforced through rules, through policy, through programs. And I'll give you an example. At the moment, it is possible that you can raise a breach of your rights with the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commission. We're still waiting to see the framework or the rules or the approach that the Commission will take to somebody raising a breach of their rights under this new statement of rights. However, leaving the enforcement of your human rights down to making a complaint means that we are relying on a breach of human rights as the only mechanism by which rights can be realised. And over and above that, we're relying on people to have the self-efficacy to raise a breach of their rights when we're talking about people for whom cognitive decline and difficulty in navigating complex bureaucracy is seriously a tough thing. Unless people have an advocate in their life or a loved one who can help negotiate the complaints process for them, we are really limiting or narrowing the kinds of people who can make a complaint. And it's actually perhaps those who have the least self-efficacy who we most need to know about whether their human rights are being achieved and promoted. So I'm really keen in seeing the aged care system administered in a way that incentivizes the promotion of rights and disincentivizes their breach through the way we fund the system, through the way we regulate the system more broadly. Because at the moment, providers have to state their compatibility with the statement of rights, but really there's nothing solid that is about anything other than the breach of your rights within the enforcement mechanism. So there are a whole bunch of signals that we can produce through the way we fund the system, through the way we regulate the system, that can bring about rights differently beyond just the laws.
And do they go back to those central concerns that you raised, detailed around the co-payment scheme is one of the areas where you could see that concretely in terms of getting it right on the front end?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, Biwa.
The disability sector, you do say, particularly when around restraint practices, there are things that have been modelled or worked in that space, particularly around training of the workforce, that could be taken on board and applied in this setting. Do you think that there's anything in particular that we can learn? I know that the NDIS has also been in the news, but around, as you say, first principles, getting things into place, getting it right from the get-go.
I can tell you so many areas that the NDIS, I think, shines a light of hope for the aged care system. In some ways, aged care has a lot of catching up to do with the principles in disability and NDIS. And having been public guardian for thousands of people with disability, I saw firsthand the life-changing effects that the right NDIS support can have. But one thing I would shine a light on here is the fact that the NDIS system is built on choice and control. When you are assessed for what supports you need, one of the chief things that you're asked about are, what are the goals of your care? What are the things that you hope to do most in your life, and how can we fund that to make that happen? That would be an amazing approach to translate into aged care.
Well, thank you so much, Natalie, for this body of work. What's your hope of what could come of this report? There have been many reports written over the years, and you'll write more, I'm sure. But in terms of what you hope will come out of this?
I am really optimistic, Biwa, that the new Act is going to set a new era for the aged care system. I do believe that the government wants to see the right legacy derive from this Act. And so I'm really looking forward to working with them on some of the more first principles things that we need to bring about to make sure we can deliver on that Act.